From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
So let me say this as plainly as I can. By August 31st, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end.
Obama's plan will bring home some 150,000 troops. But what are they coming home to? Their divorce rate is triple the national average. Alcoholism, four times the average. PTSD, unemployment, suicide, and a nation weary of the war they fought. This hour, we'll talk with veterans about coming home. But first, not everyone who went to Iraq is coming home. Some 4,200 troops have died in Iraq since the war began. Major Steve Beck knows this only too well. He is a Marine Casualty Notification Officer. His mission is the unthinkable. He knocks on the door of the next of kin of a fallen Marine. Journalist Jim Sheeler wrote a book about Major Beck and the families affected by his news. It's called Final Salute. Sheeler told Ann Strangchamps that a Marine family's worst fear is seeing Major Beck on their porch.
They know that if they see the uniformed service members on their front porch, it means the worst has happened. He says they always know. They automatically know. I've talked to mothers who've locked the door as soon as they've seen the men on the steps, and they refuse to let them in. They say that they felt at the time that if they could just prevent the message from getting to them, that it wouldn't happen, and they could delay it. But Major Beck says that they always have to. They have to always end up opening the door.
What does he say? Does he have a format?
There's a script that they're taught to memorize, but Major Beck says that he always adds a little of his own personality to it, depending on the situation, tries to gauge what the family might need at that point, what they might need to hear, that will go along with the pre-written script. And I think that's kind of what's special about him and a lot of the casualty officers. I think there are a lot of notification officers who are like Major Beck in different ways, because I believe they all bring their own personal histories to that moment. In a lot of ways, he feels that his whole life leads up to that moment. The deaths that he's seen, the people he's taken care of throughout his life, and just the ways he's been taught to care. It all culminates in that moment when that widow or mother or father opens the door and he has to find the words.
What a devastating job.
It is. It is. And it takes the toll on them as well. I mean, it has to. He says that, you know, if you don't feel it, then there's definitely something wrong. And he said that he tries to remain composed throughout the whole notification process. And oftentimes he would end up crying in the dark on the way home.
And what do the family members remember?
Usually it's that moment of seeing him is what they remember more than the actual message. And Major Beck will be the first one to say this, that him standing on the porch is the message in so many ways, that it doesn't matter what the Defense Department has told him to say. They know.
You write about several such visits that he makes, and I wondered if you could describe one of them to us. I mean, there's one, for instance, when he went to tell Second Lieutenant Jim Cathy's family.
Sure. Catherine Cathy was a pregnant 23-year-old whose husband had left not long before Major Beck showed up on her door. And she was actually taking a nap when he came to her parents' house, actually, where she was. And so her father-in-law answered the door, and he said, "Oh, no." And her mother saw him, and then she just started crying incessantly, waking Catherine up. And as he came to the door, the father-in-law came to get Catherine. She wondered what was wrong with her mother. And as soon as she saw Major Beck standing in the doorway, she knew what had happened. She was just supposed to go the next day to find out if their baby was going to be a boy or a girl. And she screamed and wouldn't look at the notification officers. She went and took a bath, a long bath. And then she came out and they waited. And when she came out, they told her what they had to.
And from there, Major Beck had to then go on and find Jim Cathy's mother and father, didn't he?
Yes, they actually coordinate the notifications so that all of the primary relatives are notified pretty much at the same time. The next of kin, who would be Catherine, his wife, would be notified first. And then once that's done, Major Beck went outside and called on a cell phone to a van full of waiting Marines in Reno, Nevada, where Jim's parents live. And so they were ready to go just around the corner. So as soon as Major Beck called them, they had to go and tell Jim's parents.
These are such devastating, difficult stories, and I think what's hard is they're so invisible. I mean, even when you read in the newspapers, you know, that perhaps a young man in your community has been killed, you don't think about this moment, about how the family learned.
Right. And it's so touching and so many times and so powerful. You know, when you think, as soon as somebody dies in Iraq or in Afghanistan, I mean, what they do first is they shut down all communication so that nobody finds out before the next of kin. They actually have a communications blackout. So
nobody emails anybody who might have
exactly
known them.
Exactly. As Major Beck says, in many cases, they're erasing the electron to try and get to the family as soon as possible to let them know in person so that they don't find out from an email or a phone call.
Does Major Beck do anything himself to prepare for making that knock at the door?
A lot of times he said he would sit in the car beforehand and look out at the house. I mean, he would almost look at the situation as if he's going into battle, a different kind of battle. It's that he had to be ready for whatever possibilities might happen. You know, if someone's screaming, if they're not, if they're quiet, if they don't want him to talk to him. He's had some of his Marines who've actually been slapped by mothers. You know, you have to prepare for all of that, he says. And then he said, you just have to force yourself to walk up there and deliver the message.
It reminds me of something you quoted Major Beck saying about that moment on the doorstep. He said, when he looks in the eyes of the family members, he says, they're falling, either literally or figuratively, and you have to catch them. In this business, I can't save his life. All I can do is catch the family while they're falling. What does that catching the family mean? I mean, it's about more than just giving them the first news that their son has been killed.
Right. That first visit is definitely not the end. It's just the beginning. He made a point of making sure that everything that they needed would be taken care of, that if they needed a special escort to bring their loved one home, he would find a way to make sure that Marine would be able to do that duty. For a long time, in some cases, the personal effects, the things that the guys had in Iraq, would just arrive a couple of weeks to a couple months later and just arrive on the family's doorstep. And Major Beck refused to allow that to happen. He personally delivered all of those effects to the family and sat with them in many cases as they went through the letters and the uniforms and the wallets of their sons and husbands. And in many cases, he was that shoulder that they cried on. And I don't know how many times I saw that shoulder of his uniform stained dark with the family's tears.
It's part of knowing what the real price of war is.
Exactly, and the sacrifice of the families. I think that's something also that people just, I as a civilian, I had no idea of the sacrifice of these families, especially for these guys who are going over three or four times, you know, to be there in the living rooms and talking to them about, you know, how it just doesn't end. And for the families, it never will end. I just spoke with one of the widows recently, and it had been 5 years since her husband was killed. And she said, you know, actually this anniversary is worse than any of the others. And I asked why. And she said, I just realized that 5 years means that I've officially known Jesse dead longer than I knew him alive. I mean, even Melissa Givens, that widow, they continue to celebrate his birthday. And he has two little boys, one little boy that never got to see him. And so on his birthday, they'll blow up helium balloons and write messages to them on the helium balloons, and then go outside and release the balloons. And I asked what they were doing, and Dakota, his younger son, said, well, we're sending the balloons to heaven. The stories, they do never end. I mean, even Dakota, when Melissa told Dakota that his dad was dead, he said, well, where is he? And she said, well, he's in heaven. And he said, well, am I going to be there? And she said, yeah, but it's going to be a long time from now. And he asked his mom, well, when I get to heaven, can I still be 5 years old so Dad can put me on his shoulders in the park?
Thank you so much for sharing these stories with us.
I think it's crucial that people know these stories, because they really need to know what these families are doing for them.
Jim Sheeler, speaking with Ann Strangechamps. His book is called Final Salute. Twenty-seven-year-old U.S. Army Sergeant John McCary was serving with the 1st Infantry Division in the Al-Anbar province of Iraq. About halfway through his one-year deployment, McCary reached a boiling point. Then on January 31, 2004, he vented in an email to his family back in North Carolina about the random violence of the war. Here's John McCary reading his email.
Dear all, we are dying. Not in some philosophical, chronological, the end comes for all of us sooner or later sense. Just dying. Sure, it's an occupational hazard, and yeah, you can get killed walking down the street in any town USA, but not like this. Not car bombs that leave craters in the road. Not jeering crowds that celebrate your destruction. It's never been a fair fight, and we haven't always played nice, but not like this. No one leaves the gate looking to kill or looking to die. No one wakes up in the morning and says, I sure hope blowing up a whole group of Iraqis goes well today. That's for suckers and cowards. People afraid to delve into the melee and fight it out, to sort it out like soldiers. They've killed my friends. And not in some heroic fight to defend sovereign territory, not on some suicide mission to extract a prisoner or save a family in distress. Just driving downtown to a meeting. Just going to work. What do you say to your men after you've scraped up the scalps of an entire Iraqi family off the road, right next to the shattered bodies of your soldiers, held together only by their shoelaces, body armor, or helmets? We're fighting the good fight. I don't think so. We're just fighting. And now we're dying. When you've held a conversation with a man, briefed him on his mission, his objective, and reminded him of the potential consequences during the actioning of it, only to hear he never returned and did not die gracefully, though blessedly quickly, prayerfully, painlessly, you do not breathe the same ever after. Breath is sweet. Sleep is sweeter. Friends are priceless. And you cry. There's no point, no gain, no benefit, but you are human, and you must mourn. It is also now undeniable, irrevocable, that you will see your mission through. You will strive every day. You will live, though you are not ever again sure why. ideals are so far, far away from the burnt stink of charred metal. We must see it through to the end. They have seen every instant, every mission, every chore, every day through, not to its end, but to theirs. They died standing with their friends, doing their jobs, fulfilling some far-flung, nearly non-existent notion called duty. They died because their friends could have died just as easily, and knowing that, they would never shirk their duties, never call in sick, never give in to fear, never let down. Their lives are lost, whether as a gift laid down at the feet of their friends or a pointless discard of precious life. I doubt I'll ever know. I'm okay, Mom. I'm just a little shaken, a little sad. I know this isn't any divine mission. No God, Allah, Jesus, Buddha, or other divinity ever decreed, go get your body ripped to shreds, it's for the better. This is man's doing. This is man's war, and war it is. It is not fair, nor right, nor simple, nor is it over. I don't care about bloodlust, justice, or revenge, but we will not give up. We cannot. Our lives are forever tied to those lost, and we cannot leave them now as we might have were they still living. We have so little time to mourn, to breathe, to laugh, to remember, to forget. Every day awaits us, impatient, impending. So now we rise, shunning tears, biting back trembling lips and stifling sobs of grief. And we walk, shoulder to shoulder, to the call of duty, in tribute to the fallen.
Sergeant John McCary served in Iraq with the U.S. Army's 1st Infantry Division at Al Anbar Province. His email is part of the National Endowment for the Arts project called Operation Homecoming. Operation Homecoming conducted writing workshops with troops in Iraq. For more information on the project, go to our website at ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Tyler Boudreaux is a 12-year veteran of the Marine Corps Infantry. In 2004, he was deployed to Iraq for a tour of duty in an infantry battalion. Following that deployment, Boudreaux was assigned as the commanding officer of a rifle company. While preparing to return to Iraq, he resigned his commission because of reservations over the legitimacy of the war. He writes about his experiences in his book Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. And Strangechamps asked Boudreaux if he was against the war from the start.
Well, there was some ambiguous feelings about it for sure. I wasn't completely sold on the invasion, but I had been in the Marine Corps for 10 years at that point, and there was a part of me that very much wanted to go to war, whatever the war, just to test my mettle and to, you know, sort of justify my existence. I mean, I was a captain at that point, and there were a lot of guys who had been to various conflicts around, and I had not, just sort of coincidentally, even though I had been in the infantry the entire time I was in the Marine Corps. So there was a part of me that wanted to go, and all I needed was some sort of justification. And when they sort of shifted gears, you know, away from the weapons of mass destruction and to a liberation of Iraqi people and helping Iraqi people, that to me was satisfactory. So I said, well, okay, in this case, I'll go and I'll try to help. And this way here, I can also, you know, perhaps get into a few fights, and this will, you know, sort of serve that craving that I've had to get into combat.
At least at the beginning, there was actually some exhilaration, some pleasure in some of the firefights. I mean, you write about one of the first big firefights you were in. There's a story you tell about Lutafia.
That's right. Lutafia was a town south of our base, and it was very hostile towards American forces. And whenever we had forces down there, they were sure to get hit in one way or the other, whether by sniper fire, or an RPG, or an IED, which is these roadside bombs. And we had sort of this growing and escalating series of battles. And so on, I think it was the second or third day of this escalation, I was traveling down with, you know, a detachment of the battalion down this road called Route Jackson. It was sort of the main road from Mamadia, which was north, to Lutafia, south. And there was a pretty significant ambush in place, and they were on both sides of the road, and there was just a lot of fire, a heavy volume of fire, and RPGs and whatnot. And so we, you know, sort of went through that. And
you write about it that, you know, you all emerged unscathed, and at the end of it, you sound joyful, like you guys are dancing around and hugging each other and really excited.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So this is what I'm talking about with, you know, a combination of the adrenaline of having survived, first of all, with, you know, you almost get sort of a sport feeling to it. And the fact that nobody got killed really kind of, you know, made it almost, you know, perpetuated the fantasy of war being not that bad in the moment.
So contrast that to, you know, fast forward a few years, and there's a chapter you write called, I think it's called One Death Too Many.
Mm.
By then, you had a totally different take on death and killing. Do you want to tell me about the One Death Too Many?
Well, the thing that I did during my deployment was gather trends. This is what we as officers are sort of trained to do, is to watch for trends and not make, you know, rash decisions on one or two incidents. And so I had my doubts about certain elements of the war, and, you know, but I wanted to give it a fair shake, if you will. And I, you know, I watched as the operations unfolded, and I always kept in the back of my mind the mission at hand, which was to help Iraqi people and to befriend Iraqi people. This was sort of a no uncertain terms kind of mission statement. There was very little ambiguity about that. And where it became ambiguous was, how do we go about helping the Iraqi people? Because we can't tell the difference between those who are trying to hurt us and those who need to be helped. And one of the problems we had on a routine basis was this Route Jackson, which was always littered with these IEDs, like I said, the roadside bombs. And we couldn't figure out what to do about it. Every time we drove down the road, a bomb went off. And, of course, the way they get the bombs on the side of the road is they dig a hole and they put a bomb inside and then they cover it back up again. So what happened was that anybody carrying a shovel became labeled a threat and was open to be shot. So there was many occasions, and one in particular that I remember, but this was sort of a frequent occasion where snipers were out on the ground and they were trying to find these guys digging holes in the ground for IEDs, and they would call me up and they'd say, you know, we've got this guy on the side of the road with a shovel, and they would request permission to engage this individual, meaning they wanted to shoot him. And, you know, they were, say, you know, 100, 200, 300 meters away from this individual with a shovel on the side of the road, and it seemed like a very unambiguous situation, except for the fact that in Iraq, many people farm at night because of the heat and because of the electrical situation. A lot of the irrigation systems were only working at night. And we knew this after a while, but the problem is that every time you asked an Iraqi, you know, whether he was a farmer or a terrorist, they would always say they were a farmer. And it got to be where we would get frustrated and started to assume that everybody we spoke to was lying, and then after a while we just stopped asking and we would just open fire on anybody with a shovel. And of course, after the fact, I started to think about that and said, well, gee, you know, I don't think that it's possible to guess right 100% of the time, which means that I had to have guessed wrong some of those times, at least once. And that means that I approved and authorized somebody, you know, a farmer getting shot, and I was not happy about that.
So you had been trained by the Marines to admire the killer inside you, you know, to find the killer inside you and then to feel proud of him. Eventually, it sounds like you became sickened by the killer inside you.
Well, yeah, that's right. They do want you to be proud of and sort of harness that killer inside you. It's true, but it's attached to a noble cause. It's always attached to a noble cause. And as long as you have that noble cause, fighting for freedom, democracy, the security of our nation, those sorts of things, defending the Constitution, then it makes sense and it's okay, I guess. You know, I mean, if you are literally defending our, you know, hearth and home and those sorts of things, then it makes more sense. It's when the mission becomes unclear or maybe, you know, you're not sure that the mission is quite just. That's when all that killing comes to the forefront and you really start to notice how terrible it is.
So you served in the Marine Corps for more than 12 years. And then after serving 1 year in Iraq, you wound up resigning your commission. Why?
I came to a point where I just no longer felt like we were fulfilling the mission that we'd gone to do. And as a commander, which I was a rifle company commander, that's not acceptable. You have to love your mission more than you love your Marines or your soldiers. And what I mean is that you have to be willing to sacrifice the lives of your men for the mission. You know, if there's a road that has to be traveled, then you've got to send those Marines down the road. If there's a hill that's got to be taken or a beachhead that's got to be taken or whatever the objective is, you know that it's going to cost lives. And so, in other words, you must love that mission more than you love your Marines. And there came to be a point where the reverse was true, where I loved my Marines more than the mission. And so I deemed myself ineligible to command any further and had to resign.
Is there any part of you that feels guilty, as though you betrayed your fellow Marines? I mean, a big part of the Marines' sort of raison d'etre is all about loyalty to each other.
I think that it would have been, in a way, disloyal to stay on and fake it, because by faking it, I could very well have cost lives that otherwise would not have been lost by being unsure or by hesitation or whatever might have unfolded had I gone to Iraq being unsure.
Do you still believe in war?
I don't rule out armed conflict because I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. But I am at the same time suspicious of many of the operations that the United States has initiated in the past and present.
Is there any part of you also that still misses war?
No. No, not at all.
Tyler Boudreau talking with Anne Strangechamps. Boudreau is the author of Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. Many troops returning from Iraq struggle with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. It took Gary Mitchell more than 30 years to identify PTSD as the reason behind his divorce, anger, nightmares, and emotional outbursts. Mitchell fought in Vietnam from 1969 to 1970. An excellent marksman and cool under pressure, he was given assignments to carry out planned assassinations. He writes about his experiences in his book, A Sniper's Journey, The Truth About the Man Behind the Rifle. Here's Mitchell reading an excerpt from the book.
I started to pick up a sight picture just as the target stopped at a stream and reached down to get a double handful of water to splash on his face. He had his back to me. He shook the water off his hands to the front and then stretched. He was in a crucifixion pose, and I took two breaths. On the second breath, I let it out half out. The reason is that the shallowest part of your breath, when you've got nothing left in your lungs, there's a tremor. At the top of your breath, when your lungs are full, there's a tremor just before you start exhaling. So you let about half of it out, which is the most stable part of your breathing cycle, and then you hold it. In AIT, they taught us to aim at the center of mass on the silhouette targets. On a man, it's the top of the breastbone. It's a perfect aiming point because if your rifle kicks up a little bit, you'll hit his head. If you drop the barrel a little bit, you'll hit his heart. If you go left or right, you're going to get a lung. The target's back was to me, but it was still center of mass. He was less than 200 meters away, so there wasn't going to be a lot of droppage of the round, and it wasn't far enough distance to worry about wind causing a deflection. It was just quick, down, and dirty. I held my breath and gently squeezed the trigger. The sound of the single shot and the relatively quiet forest seemed incredibly loud. He went head first into the stream, and Wayne said, "Cling."
That's quite a day you're writing about there. And you were 19? Just a kid?
I was 19, yes. I would have told you that I was grown, that I was a man, and puffed my boyish chest out, but I was still a kid.
This wasn't the first time you'd killed anybody?
No, no.
But it was different.
Yes, this was different because when you're in a firefight, everybody is shooting your own fully automatic or semi-automatic, and there are a lot of rounds flying around. But this was one single and hopefully precise rifle shot.
And one person whose face you could see, you were shooting at.
Still see.
Yeah.
And it's been 40 years nearly.
Well, we'll go back to that 19-year-old for a minute, because this wasn't the end. If anything, the assignments that you got became even more intense. You were asked to kill a woman, for instance, and
yes.
that ran against everything you'd ever been taught, right?
Oh, absolutely. In the generation that I grew up in, we were taught not to hurt the girls, not to hit the girls, to protect the girls. And at 19, they told me to go shoot a lady. So, you know, and
you did.
I did. Yes, I did.
Yeah. And then the one that I have to confess really got to me was you were sent out to kill four Buddhist monks.
Suffice it to say that I have little demons that walk across my pillow at night and whisper in my ear. And that's one of the things they whisper about.
What happened that day? Can you tell us the story?
Oh, my goodness. We started out the day before. It was raining. They dropped us off out in the middle of the rubber plantation near Long Bend. We went into some underground tunnels where there was a chamber in the tunnel where we slept. There was a radio there. There was food and water there. The next morning, an older monk took us out, led us through the woods into another tunnel. We came out at the base of a large tree.
And all this time you didn't actually know who you were going to be sent out to shoot, right?
No, I did not know. At that point, he told us, in about 2 hours, we'll be coming down that trail. And at that point, I realized he was going to be with the other monks. And he said, "You must kill the other four." I was asking him if there was any way that I would know who I was shooting at or any way I could see him or identify him. And he said, "If you have no other way, kill us all," and left. The man that was with me, the second that was with me, said, "How are you going to do it?" And I remembered the movie it was about Sergeant York. Saying I'm going to start from the rear. So I told him I'd start from the rear, and that way he didn't fall in front of the ones in front of him. And I also told him that I hope they run instead of drop to the ground.
Because they're better targets when they're running?
Better targets when they're running, larger targets. And even though they are moving, you can hit them easier than you can someone laying face down or on their back on the ground. So they came into the field, and I sighted on the rear monk, fired a round, and as it turned out, the monk that was our guide was number two in line. He flipped his little hood back and started running. The second said, "Have you got him?" I said, "Yes, I have." I took the guy out in front of him. Then I shot again, and I missed. By that time, the monk that had been our guide was running past us. And then I shot the fourth one, picked up our rounds, and we ran down the trail to where he was at. And he was sitting on the ground with his knees pulled up to his chest, his head down to the left of his knees. And he was crying. sobbing, and he got up and led us down to where we were supposed to catch a helicopter. And then he was just gone, and we got on the helicopter, and we were gone. To this day, I don't know why.
And to this day, clearly, that image won't leave your head.
No. No. You know, to take a line from a movie, you know, it's a hell of a thing to kill a man. And when it's the local ministers or monks or priests or rabbis or whatever, you know, I was raised going to church, and that was difficult.
Yeah. Just after that, in the book you wrote, and this is a quote, you said, "If I were a fly on the wall watching what I had done, I would say you're an executioner. But the fly isn't here. He's in my head. I can't allow myself to call myself an executioner, however irrational that may sound." You wrote that now. Do you still say that?
I do.
What do you call yourself then?
I was a shooter or a sniper. I wasn't an executioner. Didn't choose the targets. Have no idea why the targets were chosen. Have no idea what the result, the elimination of that target, did.
You did what you were told.
Did what I was told and was in the dark.
Yeah.
Still am.
You were there for most of a year. You went on 17 missions?
Yes.
21 people. How do you... I mean, this is a long time ago now. But it from the way you talk about it, clearly it's in your head, not a long time ago at all. How do you deal with that?
You know, it's been very difficult. I will tell you that the memories of it, the way it has affected me, probably cost me my first marriage. It has caused difficulties in my present marriage. It reached the point that my wife told me I had to get some help or I had needed to get a lawyer. So I started getting some help, and I've had individual counseling, group counseling, hypnotherapy. But in my case, and I can't speak for everyone, in my case, I've had the most success with acupuncture, believe it or not.
Really?
So it's... You know, it's a constant battle. I still have my moments when memories or anger, you know, I'm basically almost insane. But, you know, the rest of the time, I just have a good life. I'm married. I'm happy. We've been married nearly 28 years. So, you know, I have my moments, but the rest of it overpowers that, I think.
Yeah. Still, this has taken a toll on you, a toll that is clearly still working on you.
Well, I believe it does. And I will tell you that today we're training my replacement. You know, the people that are coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan, the people that came back from Desert Storm, they're all training to take my place. And what I want them to know is they're not alone. That they are not the only one that has ever felt things. They're not the only one that has ever cared. They're not the only one that has ever felt bad about things that they had to do.
You've done a lot of work on this, and you feel stronger, obviously, more able to deal with it. But it doesn't sound as though it's gone away.
No, it's not gone away. Anyone that you talk to will tell you that. Well, the way it was explained to me is post-traumatic stress disorder, there is no cure for. You have to learn to coexist with it. So I'm still on that journey to learn how to completely coexist with it.
Do you resent this ever? Do you resent the toll your military service has taken on you?
No, I'm not angry. Sometimes I'd like to be, but, you know, when I wake up at midnight and I don't sleep till 4 in the morning, or when I go to bed for a good night's sleep and I take a vacation back in time, and the little demons whisper in your ear, sure, sometimes I'd like to be angry, but that was 40 years ago, and You know, there was a time I might have been angry, but not now. Do I regret some of the things that I saw? Yes, I do. Do I regret some of the things that I had to do? I wouldn't be human if I didn't. But do I regret serving? Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Gary Mitchell is the author of A Sniper's Journey, The Truth About the Man Behind the Rifle. Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Sergeant First Class Toby Nunn served two tours of duty in Iraq. He's experienced the violence, destruction, and stress of heavy combat. Nunn says after living 24/7 with your finger on the trigger and nostrils flared, it's very hard to adjust back to civilian life. He told Steve Paulson that, not surprisingly, for many of the men in his platoon, the transition isn't going very well.
Sadly, and, you know, I'm not going to quote statistics because I hate to be inaccurate, but I think that you will find a trend is the majority of the guys returning have been there before, so this won't be their first return trip home. So they kind of have a good idea of what to expect, but I do think that they're going to find a supportive nation, one that's a little tired and weary from this longer conflict, but I think they're going to find that they are supported. However, there's not a lot of jobs out there right now. The unemployment rate for returning veterans, you know, is in double digits. You know, the homeless rate is extremely high. I believe that's in double digits as well. And, you know, with everybody here in America fighting for those jobs and taking the time to get an education and making themselves a little more competitive, our service members that have been serving the country have lost that, you know, workplace competitive edge. So I think they're going to find themselves in a tough position to find employment and employment that's suiting to their talents and skill sets.
Well, there are some other statistics as well reflecting some of the personal trauma. Divorce rate is triple the national average for veterans. Alcoholism is something like four times the national average. Suicide rates are just off the charts. You surprised by those figures?
I'm going to answer this carefully. I myself was surprised. And one of the reasons I myself was surprised because I've always been one of those guys that thought this would never happen to me. I'm not that guy. You know, I'm squared away. I've had a good career. I've done everything by the book and done things right. Stuff like that doesn't happen to me. And I came back and my wife and I struggled. And, you know, it's not because she's a bad person or I'm a bad person or we don't love each other. It just, you know, you have these experiences and it makes it extremely tough. So I thought, you know, having a very safe and secure marriage and with kids that I would be immune to these things. And I found that even my wife and I struggled and, you know, we've made it through for the most part, but it's not surprising. And especially, you know, I see my soldiers all the time, you know, calling me and letting me know that yet again, they've become a statistic. The suicide rate, unfortunately, it's sad because a lot of the reasons why these guys do it is because that change of pace and that alienation, going from having a support structure that's immediate and understanding to being alone and misunderstood with no support structure in the form of battle buddies and friendship and that typical fellowship you feel with your comrades. And, you know, that's sad that these guys and gals, you know, go out like that. And alcohol, you know, I too am guilty. You know, there's It's a lot easier to go to sleep when you have a belly full of booze than it is when your mind's wide awake and you're just sitting there.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any regrets about joining the army, about going off to Iraq to fight in this war?
Absolutely not. You know, there's some things I wish I hadn't seen, but there's nothing I regret doing, and I don't regret joining, and I don't regret my service. I think it's an important part of what's defined me as a person, as an adult, and as a human. I think that we have to have these experiences to appreciate ourselves and our families and our friends more. I also appreciate a toilet and a warm meal a lot more than I used to. But absolutely not. You know, as a military member, I'm not afforded a political opinion, and I like that. I like the fact that I serve something greater than just myself and my own personal views. So the political aspect of it for me never got involved. It was something that I needed to do for myself and to earn my citizenship. And on my second tour, it was important for me to make sure that I led those guys the best that I could, because, you know, we need good leadership. We need good performers, and we need guys that understand the big picture. And sometimes we get a little lost in the tunnel vision of what's going on in our own personal lives and not the big strategic impact of our country. And I know that it's important that guys like me go out and do that. Mm-hmm. So
let me follow up on that, because you were the subject of a documentary that was made about your squad. It was called Bad Voodoo's War. And one of the things that was very clear about that was that you felt a personal responsibility to care for the guys in your squad. I mean, you were going to do everything you could to bring them back alive and hopefully in one piece. Do you still feel that sense of responsibility now that you're home?
Absolutely. Any soldier that I've had the honor to lead or be around is, you know, someone very dear and special to me. Even the guys that didn't like me and I didn't like, you know, they're still very, very dear to me. And the awesome responsibility of human life weighs heavy. And when a mom charges you with the health and welfare of her son or a wife or a child, depends on you to make sure that their dad makes it back all right. You can't take that lightly. And I think anyone that just laughs at it off or shrugs it off is a terrible leadership failure. You know, I care about these guys still. You know, I'm leaving tomorrow to go out and, you know, yank the head out of one of my guys' butts because, you know, he's been a knucklehead since he's been back. Because, you know, it's tough on these young guys. They spend a lot of time overseas living 10 seconds at a time. They don't think that they have to plan for the future. And when you go through life living it 10 seconds at a time, you don't save your money, you don't, you know, plan your future, you don't react to things in a timely manner, and you find yourself in a lot of trouble that, you know, you typically won't find because your entire adult life's been spent dealing with survival, physical survival. And, you know, when you look at Maslow's hierarchy, and it's tough to believe that, you know, a large portion of our youth are dealing on the lowest level, and that's just mainly subsistence.
You mentioned that you haven't regretted your service, your time in Iraq, although you wish you hadn't seen certain things. And I'm wondering if you've had to do some work personally to try to deal with that.
There will be, and there will be for a long period of time, stuff that I'm going to have to, you know, deal with. You know, without getting too graphic, being a father, it's tough to turn, you know, those parental emotions off when, you know, you're seeing a kid's life being wasted mindlessly. And, you know, you see a bright future just disappear in a pink mist. It's just stuff like that bothers me, and it always will. It helps me appreciate my kids. It definitely makes me really protective. I take my daughter to the grocery store, and, I don't think the shopping cart gets without 6 inches of my grasp at any moment in time. I see other parents, you know, walking around the produce section with their kids at one section and, you know, them at the other. I can't do that. You know, I just, you know, the human life is just too precious, and I get a little protective of, especially the kids. So stuff like that, I wish that, you know, I'm glad that I've had the experience, and I'm not ashamed, or I don't regret any single time I pulled the trigger, any time I picked up the radio and made a decision. But You know, when you see, you know, kids, you know, body parts, you know, strewn out over a street because they were just, you know, at the school bus stop or at the crosswalk waiting to go to school, and, you know, and someone mindlessly detonated a car bomb near them or a device. Yeah, it just bothers you, you know, because, you know, those kids, you know, they're not the enemy. They're not a political agenda. They're just kids. You know, they're victims of terrorism, which is sad because they don't understand what terrorism is. And I hate to see the waste of innocent human life, and that's something that I probably will always struggle with.
Mm-hmm. You've still got young kids yourself. Would you like to see them join the military at some point?
Well, you know, my son, my oldest, is 11, and, you know, we have this terrible rivalry because he wants to be a Marine and I was a soldier. And but, you know, I think if my son wants to serve his nation, that I will support him in that venture. I would prefer that he does it in a time of peace. You know, I don't want to lose one of my children. But it would be hypocritical for me to sit up here and talk about the value of what I've learned serving and then shortchange him that opportunity.
Thank
but
you.
But I would prefer a time of peace.
Yeah. Thank you.
And an administrative job.
Sergeant First Class Toby Nunn served 2 tours of duty in Iraq. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Nunn currently works for the nonprofit organization Soldiers Angels. Soldiers Angels supports veterans and deployed military personnel and their families, from their Adopt a Soldier program to coordinating homemade quilts for wounded veterans. Their motto, may no soldier go unloved, may no soldier walk alone, may no soldier be forgotten until they all come home. For information on Soldiers Angels, please go to our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Coming Home from Iraq, program number 426A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.